The scripture reading today is from Mark 13, verses 1 and 2. As Jesus was leaving the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Teacher, look at those beautiful stones and beautiful, wonderful buildings." Jesus replied, "Do you see those huge buildings? They will certainly be torn down. Not one stone will be left in place."
We are reading the Bible cover to cover in 2017. And as I was preparing for this, a theme came to my mind of home. And I've been thinking of the narratives of the Bible in terms of either leaving home or losing home. Whether it's Genesis to 2 Chronicles, which is the Hebrew scriptures, the Tanakh, or from Genesis to Revelation in the Christian canon, both begin with humans at home in the garden, but they don't get to stay there long. The human condition lives east of Eden, no real home. And so perhaps the story is the quest to find home again. The Tanakh ends with the promise and the desire to go up to Jerusalem. Those are the last words in the Hebrew scriptures, the Hebrew canon. Of course, in Revelation, the Christian scriptures end with the scene of the heavenly Jerusalem coming down from the heavens, where every tear will be wiped away. Home to home, garden to holy city. And that's the journey of individual lives, too. We begin in the womb, and we end in the tomb. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. What was it like before we were born? What is it like when we die? It isn't a matter of not knowing, it's a matter of not even being able to comprehend non-being. It's mystery to mystery. But that doesn't stop us from imagining. We imagine and we attempt to manipulate, to get ahead of the game, to plan for the eternal. Religious traditions have encouraged this, and they provide stories and teachings and practices to manage this mystery of non-being. But we don't live in the eternal, the before or the after. We live in this homeless now. Foxes have holes, birds have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. A reflection attributed to Jesus. The context is that following him is about voluntarily leaving the responsibilities and the concerns of home. "Let the dead bury their own dead," he says. Hit the road. Perhaps he's talking about the human experience, the burden of self-conscious awareness of our own deaths. Foxes and birds don't worry over the mysteries of the eternal, at least we assume, but humans do. We live with the terror of our own demise. We have nowhere to lay our heads. We can't become foxes or birds. We know too much. We live knowing that the loss of everything we have and are is coming. When my children were little, Katie and Zachary, we lived in New York, and we had a little friend across the street whose name was John, precocious boy. His mother told us a story of overhearing him talk with a little girl who was a friend of theirs. They were probably about 6 or 7, and the little girl had just lost her grandmother, and she was upset, and she's outside, and she told John that she had lost her grandmother. And he hadn't quite yet learned the art of showing sympathy. And instead, he said, "Yeah, well, we all die. Your grandmother died, your mom will die, your dad will die, I'm going to die, you're going to die. Everybody dies." The little girl ran crying into the house. Now, while he might have been a little more compassionate, he did tell the truth. We all die. Not only individuals, but societies, empires, economies. Nothing lasts forever. Nothing is permanent. The Buddha recognized that. That's why he got famous. Upon his awakening, he said that life is dukkha, Sanskrit for often translated as suffering. But it isn't a physical suffering. It's an emotional and mental anguish that comes from wanting what we cannot have. It's the anguish that comes from expecting that things should be different than they are and spending our time, energy, focus, and action on the attempt to retain what is impossible to retain. Dukkha is the anxiety, the bitterness, the spinning, the unhappiness. Dukkha is the problem. But, said Buddha, dukkha is avoidable. We can train our minds. The problem is not that we're going to die, nor is it physical suffering or illness or poverty or wealth. Dukkha has a cause, and that cause is anxiety about the whole thing. And that's the second noble truth. Dukkha is caused by desire. But that isn't quite the right word either. Clinging might be better. Grasping. It's as the preacher in Ecclesiastes says, chasing after the wind. It comes from the illusion that there is such a thing as permanence. We want things to stay the same, or we want them to be different. We want control. But we are seeking to control what we cannot control. There is an element of control, and that's the solution. According to the Buddha, life is dukkha. Life is this spinning, first truth. That's our existential condition. We know too much. Unlike the foxes and the birds, we know that everything slips away. We don't want that, so we cling and grasp to what is there. And that clinging and that grasping is the second noble truth. Dukkha is caused by grasping at what is not real. But, says Buddha, here's the good news. We can cease grasping. We can stop grasping, clinging, and craving what we cannot attain. We can be content. Happiness is possible. That's the third noble truth. Stop grasping, and we will cease dukkha. And how do we do this? Well, the Buddha has the fourth noble truth, which is the Eightfold Path. And this is essentially about cultivating discipline and mindfulness. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right meditation. I'm not going to go into the specifics about them, but in general, they're about living a life of discipline and truth. Primary truth being that nothing is permanent. Now, the Buddha's Four Noble Truths are not a religion. They aren't about beliefs. They are applicable to any other religion or philosophy or view of the world. I find them helpful in interpreting Christian texts. Want to be happy? Buddha says, great, it takes some work. Happiness does not come from having external things line up for us. It comes about living amidst impermanence with mindfulness. It is, as my sermon title reads, being real when things fall apart. And things will fall apart. And when they do, we can splash around in anxiety and tantrums and blaming. And when we finally tire of that, we can clarify what is true and be mindful. So many of the teachings of Jesus have a resonance with Buddha's Four Noble Truths. Jesus is teaching his disciples about impermanence when he shows them something about the impressive temple, a fortress that Herod the Great built, a temple that supposedly housed God. On one hand, a source of pride for the Jewish people, but on the other hand, a vehicle for oppression as well. And Jesus demonstrated in Holy Week in the temple. Remember, he turned over the tables, and in one gospel account has him cracking a whip. And while he's doing it, he quotes Jeremiah. He says, the house of prayer has become a den of robbers. And that's often interpreted as Jesus being angry that they're selling stuff in the temple. But that isn't the problem. Robbers don't rob in their den. They hide in the den after they do their robbing in the outside. And that's what the temple had become for Jeremiah and for Jesus, a place that gave holy blessing to a lot of crimes, a hiding place for bandits. The temple's institution participated and collaborated with the oppression of the poor and the landless. Not one stone upon another, says Jesus, about the temple's fate? A lesson in impermanence. If you see the temple as magnificent, as great, as the source of pride for Israel, or as a source of repression and injustice, the fate's the same. Not one stone will be left upon another. Scholars think those words were put on the mouth of Jesus by the gospel writers after the fact. The temple was, in fact, destroyed by the Romans during the Jewish-Roman War around 70 CE, about 40 years after the death of Jesus. The gospel writers, beginning with Mark, wrote his version of Jesus after that fact and then had Jesus predict the temple's destruction. It's often how it works in the scriptures. And that makes sense to me. But even so, I think the words of Jesus are saying words of truth that are even more than the historical reality of the Jewish-Roman War. I hear Jesus talking about a larger reality. All temples will be destroyed. After the World Trade Center Towers 1 and 2 and Building 7, later that same afternoon, were brought down by explosives on September 11th, 2001, a truth that most of us have not yet been able to own, even as the evidence is right in front of our eyes. The powers that be didn't waste much time in building another monstrosity. We should have instead turned Ground Zero into a homeless camp, a tent city, a living memorial of the reality of impermanence. All temples will be destroyed, even those that worship the god of empire and exploitation. Crazy old Ezekiel saw the same thing. Ezekiel, with his vision of a wheel within a wheel, has been marvelous fodder for UFO believers. Google Ezekiel's wheel. He saw a spaceship, they suggest. Or perhaps good old Zeke was just under the influence of psychedelics. What a long, strange trip it has been. But Ezekiel understood impermanence. His vision of God on the chariot was a sermon of hope, after all. God wasn't confined to the temple. And that's the first temple. That was Solomon's temple. Herod's temple that Jesus is talking about was actually the third temple. And there is a second temple, and that was the smaller one built by those who returned from exile. You'll find that story in Ezra and Nehemiah. And Ezekiel was a member of the first deportation to Babylon in 597 BC. 10 years later, the Babylonians destroyed the temple in 587 BC. More Jews were deported to Babylon. And it's in Babylon, on the Chebar River, that Ezekiel has a vision of Yahweh on the chariot. God is not confined to the temple, but on the move. Even the house of God is impermanent. And the hope was that even as the people were conquered and humiliated militarily, Ezekiel was one of the prophets that declared that their identity as a people was not destroyed. Like dry bones coming back to life, like Yahweh astride a magical SUV flying to Babylon, so impermanence has its good points. Some things we want to cling to are better left go. Life has a way of rearranging itself. Buddha's four truths remind us that the suffering caused by clinging is not the experience of individuals only. When the powerful cling, destruction happens to others as well. It's really game over for the American empire when we think that we need to build walls to keep out immigrants and to examine people naked in x-ray machines before they board airplanes, hold people without trial, resort to torture as just another means of interrogation, and spy on citizens in every clever way possible. It's a sign that the temple is coming down. Look at those beautiful stones and wonderful buildings, the disciples blurt out. Jesus gives them the hard truth. They will certainly be torn down and not one stone will be left in place. America is not going to be great again, no matter what the demagogue tweets about it. It is going to become humble again. And that is not bad news even as there will be much suffering as the mighty billionaires cling to power before they fall. But our hope is not in them. Humankind, and Americans in particular, will one day see clearly when the fog of deception and exceptionalism is lifted. Then it will be the least of these, the remnant, as the ancient texts always say, who through kindness and human caring, who through Buddha's Eightfold Path and Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, will call us back to our courageous, decent selves. That's how we are real when things fall apart.